Hola, mira. My name is Miklós Veres. I am the chair of this last oral session of the conference. In this photonic session, we will have three presentations. The first will be given by Martin Schulze, who is from the Technical University of Graz, and the title talk is Wigner Time Delays and Controlling Electrons and Spins.
Thanks.
So, please.
So I got a bit scared by this audio. Can you hear me? I can hear me. That is probably a good sign. So. Then I was instructed to stand somewhere here. I'll do this now. Okay, thanks. It's really a privilege to be here and be allowed to present a few of our experiments in this audience. So I'm visiting from Austria, from Graz. So I arrived yesterday and I already enjoyed the venue and discussions with some of you. Thanks again for the opportunity. So I will talk you through this like two, three experiments where we used what you already have seen this in the morning, the methodology of attosecond spectroscopy in its broadest sense to inspect electronic motion, spin motion in systems. And the systems we believe get more and more interesting over time. But this started at least when I joined as a young PhD student, when I joined the field, this started with inspecting electronic motion in atoms still. And there were things that, at least certainly, I was not aware, and I think the largest part of the field was also not aware. One of them is this Wigner time delay that I'll try to walk you through briefly, what you believe, what we've seen there. So this is the button for the next slide. Yes. So the short version of the short version is, I'll try to show you a few things where we use or attempt to use ultrafast light pulses, so these single cycle waveforms you've already seen, as a remote control for charges and spins. And now I will show you a few experiments, and then in the end, you have to judge whether this makes sense to you at all. It does to me, but of course, I'll try to convince you. So single cycle waveforms as a remote control for charges and spins. Can we deliberately achieve an electronic state of matter that it doesn't want to take on its own, or transiently create an unusual electronic or even spin state? Okay. So I should say for full transparency that I graduated from one of the speakers in the morning. Some of the results in the slides are actually not from Graz, but from Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, where I spent quite a while, and Max Planck Quantum Optics in Garching. So, and then I had Wigner in the title, so I'm not Hungarian, as you might have figured out, but at least I have lots of Hungarian physics inside the talk, if you know me. Okay, so. The thing that really struck me after I understood the measurement better, first we did the measurement, was that and I just said this a few minutes ago, how far in the after the war, before the 50s even, Wigner was in this thinking of these scattering events. So in 1905, of course, photoelectric effect, right? And if you want to see it, like this is a quantum collision, right? The photon rushes in and you have this cartoon helium atom. And if the photon is energetic enough, an electron pops off. It's a quantum collision, if you want. So already in the 50s, before the 50s, I put the citations there. So this Wigner-Eisenbart paper in 47, and then Wigner alone in 55. They noticed that there is a phase shift of the wave packet associated to this collision event. So In simple terms, if you would compare a free electron just traveling through vacuum with an electron that was somehow involved in this scattering event, then they would have different phase if you detected the two at the end. So, and Wigner very politely puts, I think, in this 55 paper that if this scattering phase, I'll elaborate on the phase shift in the next two slides a bit better, if this phase shift is not uniform for all energies that the incoming electron could have. So an energy derivative of this phase shift with non-zero value, this actually has a time domain implication that translates to a time shift. And they, in 47, they published this and they cite the 47 paper has a citation that this was actually worked out by Eisenbart alone in his PhD thesis. Now everyone cites this statement, but the PhD thesis is not published. At least I haven't seen it. It's a Princeton University Press. I don't know if anyone has ever seen it except Wigner. So maybe that was one of these polite statements like that was referred to in the morning already. It's impressive. But they noticed that time where nobody, I believe, nobody really thought about time domain implications in something very straightforward like the photoelectric effect. They already knew. But then it took us, not us, well, I looked at it only, but it took 60 more years to come to the point where an experiment could actually even attack the question, is there experimental proof for this time domain implication of the scattering fields? And this is what I'll try to explain you briefly with a phase space trajectory here. So imagine you have a bobsled, this one, and then I give it a kick, and after a certain time, I measure how far it traveled. So it traveled this far when I gave it a certain kick. Now, if I take the same bobsled, but it's on such a surface, and I give it the same kick, then in the same time, it will have traveled further because it accelerates briefly. So the transversal velocity increases and then decelerates as the same terminal velocity, but it got a bit further, right? And of course, you could also say it's a bit of time shift if you look at one time where they are. The lower one would actually arrive first. Now, that's not quantum mechanics, obviously, but it's not even this half-scattering event of the photoelectric effect. Allow me to briefly mention this. The photoelectric effect, the electron starts in a bound state, then the photon rushes in, does this quantum collision, if you want to see it that way, and then the photon is absorbed and the photoelectron moves out. So the bobsled analogy to this would be, I give the bobsled a kick while it's in the valley, and I give it the proper kick to have the same terminal velocity as this sled that just moves in the flat plane. If I do so, it still travels for half of the time it's in the valley, it travels faster than the upper one, it still arrives earlier. Now, let's look at this with waves. It's still the same picture. It looks more quantum mechanical if I plot this way. Let's say this is the attractive potential. I plot potential here. This is the bound state of an electron, and I send in an attosecond XeV pulse. So very energetic photons, energetic enough to do single photon photo emission of these electrons. So I get the wave packet. Now, the wavelength of this wave packet, like the matter wavelength, of course, will depend on the energy of the outgoing electron. If the excess energy of this photon is gigantic, short wavelength comes out and so on. And then these wave packets will propagate into vacuum. They will self-disperse what electrons do in vacuum. Now, if this photoionization, of course, it happens in this attractive potential presented by the atom. The thing is, since these wave packets have to propagate away from the nucleus, and that's why they call it half scattering event, right? It's not photo, not electron in scattering, electron out, but it's sort of you generate the traveling electron at the position where the atom is, and then it moves out. So it's only half of a scattering event. Still, while moving out, the wave packet acquires a phase shift compared to a vacuum, compared to an electron traveling in vacuum. And this is not proof, it's just a plot, but the phase shift, of course, since the wavelength is different for different kinetic energies, the phase shift is also different. So there is an energy-dependent phase shift. And that's Wigner in 47, they somehow figured, oh, this actually is a time shift, if you want to see it that way. I don't think there were many people around that even agreed on the statement, but they somehow understood this. Now, can we measure this? Let's try. I'll try to walk you through an experiment where we attack this energy derivative of the phase shift in time domain, where we try to observe time delay in photo emission. Now, the experiment in very, very basic terms and under omission of all the technical details goes like this. So let's imagine the two electrons in the helium-1 is ground state. If I send in an attosecond pulse, so photons energetic enough to cause single photon photoelectron emission, around 100 eV photon energy or so, 13 nanometer wavelength. Then an electron flies out. So the other electron, because of course the screening changes, the other electron actually snuggles into a state that is deeper bound than when there were still two electrons, right? So it's called shakedown. One electron out and the other one goes into a deeper bound state. The other option that these two electrons have, so that's just the photoelectric effect. The other option the two electrons have is they share some of this kinetic energy, some of this excess energy, and project the other electron into an excited but still bound state. So that's the shake-up channel. And then there are actually many, right? You can imagine this is entire, like even a Rydberg series of excited states close to the ionization continuum, but still one electron flies off and the other electron remains bound. So one photon in, one atom can only do one of the two options, obviously, right? But how do you distinguish them experimentally? Well, if the atom shows this option, the kinetic energy of the outgoing photoelectron is this. And if it shows the other option, the kinetic energy of the outgoing electron is this. So they are different. By time of flight detection, time of flight electron spectroscopy, we can just tell whether the atom did the one or the other. Then we still need to add time resolution. And time resolution, we add by effectively applying a cross-correlation method again, right? So we subject many helium atoms to many photons contained in an attosecond pulse. Some do this, some do the other. And then at the same time, we illuminate the helium atoms with a strong electric field of something, a very short optical pulse. Now, this is just for, in the moment when this photoelectron is born, this is a constant electric field across space, right? So this electron will have its kinetic energy, and then the presence of the electric field will change this kinetic energy. It will pull it to one or the other direction. It can accelerate it or decelerate it a bit, depending now on the arrival time difference between this so-called streaking field and the attosecond pulse that gave birth to the photoelectron. So that means you should expect in the plot I'm about to show two lines with photoelectron counts, and these two lines will be modulated according to the arrival time difference of these two pulses. So yes, you see two wiggly lines. So this is a so-called streaking spectrogram or attosecond streaking spectrogram of those photoelectrons that did directly the photoelectric effect, and then the other ones that did this shake-up process. Now that time we were excited because we felt like, okay, this shake-up process, this at least requires these two electrons to somehow interact, right? So electronic correlations, if you want, in the bold words. Anyways, if you had a good ruler and good glasses, you would probably still not make out that these two curves, which are like an oscilloscope measurement of the oscillating electric field of this laser field, these two curves are slightly offset along the arrival time difference axis. So that means the one process apparently happens a bit faster than the other. Those electrons that did the shake-up appear ionized a few attoseconds earlier than the others appear ionized. That is the Wigner time shift in photoemission. So it is now in literature, it's called EWS time delay, Eisenblatt, Wigner, Smith. So I think these two figured it out, and then Smith extended it to more dimensions, I believe. That's my take. Maybe I'm doing injustice to Smith again. So, and then how precise does this get? Actually, cool precise. So helium has the advantage, of course, that you can still solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation to a very good level of accuracy, right? So this is the plot. Photon energy, so we did this measurement series for several central photon energies. This is what the colleagues, Joachim Burgdorf in Vienna and so on, computed for the time shift of the direct photo emission. So these few attoseconds would be the time between the arrival of the photon and the emission of the photoelectron that this does the direct photo emission. And then this is what we measured between direct photo emission and shake-up photo emission. Remember, the measurement, of course, measures a relative time between these two options, not an absolute laboratory time, right? So this is what we measured at this photon energy, and then we measured at a few other photon energies, and then the overlap with theory is just one. Not only the overlap with theory of our measurement data, and then we were not used to this in attoseconds before, not only the agreement with the TDSE is excellent, also the error bars are insanely small. So I still believe, I checked in the morning, this is data from 2017, I still believe this is the physical event, the duration of which is measured to the best accuracy and precision. Now, it's a bold statement, of course, but it's really, it's insanely accurate timing measurement. And then you could say what we measure there really is just, or skip the just, what we measure there is the phase, is the energy dependence of the scattering phase in the photoelectric effect in time, sampled in time domain, as Wigner had foreseen. One should have known. Now, that is a bit to advertise how accurate this attosecond stuff now gets. The question is in the title, I promised also a bit controlling. Now we have to see how far we get with controlling. But I will show you now a few experiments done in solid state systems where, of course, electronic interactions, electronic correlations are even more influential for what is going on. So is this important? Now I would argue this is important based on the slide that shall tell you about relevant timescales for electronic processes in solids. Now, if you think, so here's the names of dozens of mysterious interactions between electrons and electrons, electrons in holes, electrons and phonons, everything. If you think we take a short light wave, coherent light wave, right? We can probably excite an electron hole pair in a solid in certainly less than a femtosecond. Less than an attosecond, I don't know, but super fast. So fast that it's, I think, plausible to assume that all these interactions, scatterings, have not yet had time to act out. So I think it's plausible to assume that at femtosecond zero, when we create this electron hole pair, this is still a coherent object like we would be totally used to in a two-level atomic system, right? And in a two-level system, we have all the time of the world to affect this coherent wave packet we created later, because there's not really channels for loss of coherence. In a solid, this is numerous channels for quick loss of coherence and dephasing. And a bit frustrating is that if you believe me, we can create an electron hole pair, a wave packet in a few attoseconds, then to see that state-of-the-art electronics works at nanoseconds, or at best, I think the fastest transistor now in lab is 400 picoseconds rise time. So this is orders of magnitude slower than we can electronically affect matter by light. And then the other thing that is a bit annoying about conventional electronics, I believe, is that really you can only turn on a transistor. You cannot turn it off, right? We have to wait for it to turn off. We have to effectively wait for it to cool down. So that is a very hard limit for how fast you can speed this up, because you will never skip the waiting time for it to return to its non-conductive state. Now, coherent control, of course, would be super cool, because not only you could turn it on deliberately and fast, you could also turn it off. So what is between us and coherent control in real world solids and at real temperatures is all these nasty processes, right? Like in 20 years from now, I would be really thrilled if we could outperform a few of those along the time domain dimension. Because now what is a quantum computer? Is effectively you build a gigantic cooling around your system to make the coherence lifetime long, right? To slow down all these processes. Maybe super fast manipulation would be an extra handle we have to become better at. I said quantum computer. I promise to only say it once. At sophisticated ways to do electronics. Okay, so here are my examples. Now, electronics is not shining light on something and then measuring with a spectrometer that it changed, right? I see by eye that there's petahertz oscillations in a piece of glass window if the sun shines through. This is not electronics. Electronics, to my taste, is if you can attach wires and detect signals in external circuitry. So optoelectronics really needs not only a super fast response, but also interfacing to electronics the way we are used to. So can we think of this? Now there's, from the 80s, Austin recognized that you can actually, by illuminating a slab of semiconductor with a short light pulse, you can quickly make it conductive and use this rapid onset of conductivity for effectively chopping electric signals in time and measuring their temporal evolution. So we did the same. We did an Austin switch just in lithium fluoride, a wide gap dielectric, and we had synthesized sub-femtosecond duration UV pulses matched to the 14 EV band gap of lithium fluoride. So what would this do? It just takes carriers from the valence band and injects a wave packet in the conduction band in less than a femtosecond. And then we do the same experiment, the streaking that I already showed you. We illuminate the same slab of lithium fluoride with a laser dressing field. So what will this laser dressing field do? The very same thing it did in the atom that I showed you. It will grab this wave packet and modify its momentum. Now, it will modify its momentum again as a function of arrival time difference of these two pulses. So the inject and then this gate pulse, if you want, but it will modify the momentum, of course, in the dispersion relation of the atom, of the solid, in the band structure. It will move around a wave packet deliberately in the band structure, in the conduction band manifold of the solid. So how would we detect it? In external wires, where we just literally glue electrodes to this piece of material and check in the transimpedance amplifier whether we see any current going through the signal changing when we change this arrival time difference. And now here's my Hollywood movie. Now, of course, a super shabby cell phone movie from the lab, but I'm emotionally attached to it because the first time we saw it working was really cool. Yes. So what you see there is two things. It's fast. Now, really in like 30 seconds, we can measure the entire temporal evolution of an octave spanning optical field in our experiment. Has nice signal to noise, a large dynamic range and everything. And you see this method is very good in sampling electric field as a function of time. So you can think of absorption spectroscopy just in time domain. We've seen in the morning how far you can take this even to biological ideas and so on. Now, you also can finally measure that your super short pulse that we are proud of is not so super short if you're also interested in lower amplitude oscillations around it. But there's really a lot of physics in the signals that we obtain. Again, it's not optical signals, it's really signals detected at the output of a BNC cable. This is through optoelectronics. Now, the physics idea still would be we have the sub-femtosecond injection of a wave packet in the first conduction band, and then the light field pushes this around in the conduction band. If this light field is strong, though, it will do a lot of pushing. It will push the wave packet so far that it eventually bounces at the edge of the Brillouin zone. And then that's somehow discontinuity, right? So it will literally bounce at the edge of the Brillouin zone and then do something. So higher frequencies or something. What it will certainly do is it will take part of this wave packet to here, where the band gap between the first and the second conduction band is very narrow. So some of this population will couple into a higher band. Then the light field turns around. It takes this wave packet and pushes it back, but some of this is actually in the other band with opposite curvature. So it makes a current in the opposite direction. It actually makes a lot of mess. Anyways, I'm showing you this because when we understood this in tandem with theory, I think this is really a nice tool to attack relevant solid state dynamics questions, because we can extract from this measurement as a function of time, band resolved the occupation. So for each moment in time, we can tell for the first 3, 4 conduction bands and the first 1, 2, 3 valence bands, we can tell how much occupation is in this band. And then make these beautiful plots. Look here, wave packet creation, then the laser pulse wiggles it around, then at this time, some population pops up in this band, then there's a diabatic crossing to higher bands. Very rich dynamics. And then, okay, it was, by measures, I don't know, somehow in the physics world, top 10, 2020, I'm showing this to show off, but not only to show off, but to really convey the point that I want to make here that I believe is important. We get access to these time and band resolved occupations. And if I look into solid state physics books, I'm not a trained solid state physicist, there's not so much about time really, right? Not because people overlooked it, because it's very complicated due to all these couplings and processes. I think with this more modern experimental methodology, I think we have tools at hand to attack these complicated couplings, maybe from a new perspective, and learn more about time in solid state physics too. Okay, so the method is also a method to sample electric fields as a function of time. So now this is just three slides to show you a fancy effect that I'm excited about. Then we still have to really sort out what is going on. But I want to show you an example of what I meant by saying you can think of absorption spectroscopy in time domain. So just imagine a thin film of nickel, 8 nanometer thickness. And I will show you what happens if you shine a short laser pulse through nickel. This is the electric field at the input. This is the electric field at the output. So after the nickel film, if the intensity was 5 × 10^11 watts per square centimeter, this is already about half a volt per angstrom field amplitude is a lot. Okay, so this looks reasonable, right? The amplitude is diminished. So less light at the output than at the input looks reasonable. Now I'll do an experiment. I send in the same pulse at higher intensity, but same energy content. So the pulse energy did not increase, but the intensity increased. It's, you could say, the same number of photons impinging in these two pulses. But what you see is a bit disturbing. The stronger pulse is better transmitted if you look at these half cycles. So the pulse has the same amount of energy, but the transmission is higher. Well, it's nonlinear optics. It's a nonlinearity you probably know. It's saturable absorption. So the sample reflects and absorbs, and above a certain intensity, it cannot really absorb well anymore because you just blow out all the population. So saturable absorption, cool. So what can we do experimentally? The one knob we always have is we can try more light, right? More intensity, still same pulse energy. So how would that look? I called it super nonlinear optics. So watch what happens. Now I take this pulse and still crank up the intensity. And what you see is, whoa, this gets even more transparent. So we are even further in the saturable absorption. Actually, it gets very, very transparent. About 85% of the energy is transmitted, though in the linear case, this sample already reflects 40%. So this sample really turns very transparent as reaction to these short pulses. So then, of course, the only experimental approach to this we could have is we have to try more intensity, right? So more intensity, now watch what happens. Now the trend turns around. So intensity 1, 2, 3, and 4. So saturable absorption, and then then it turns around. So it seems like the saturable absorption, which is a nonlinearity already, is not well behaved. There is an extra nonlinearity on top of this for even higher intensities. And it's a bit alarming. There is also a phase shift. So if you would inspect closely, this wave and this wave and this wave are perfectly phase synchronized. And this one at the highest intensity is pulled a bit forward to negative times. So that looks disturbing. So the only handle we have in the experiment, of course, is we have to try more light. So here's the next plot. That's the last time I can do the trick because it's the highest intensity the sample would ever survive. Again, this now is a 4 nanometer thick nickel film. So this is, if you look at it, it's a bit greenish, but it's effectively transparent. It's 4 nanometers only, right? So we shine this incident field, and at the output, we get this field. So two things you recognize. This is in the presence of some reflection and some absorption. The blue curve, the transmitted curve, is weaker than the incident curve. The alarming thing, though, is it is shifted by almost a quarter of the cycle duration to negative times. So this literally means this wave packet, this group, pops out at the rear side of this nickel film earlier than if the nickel film wasn't there. So then I thought, oh, we did a mistake here. Superluminal is dangerous. This can't be true. In the meantime, I convinced myself otherwise. We obtained this gigantic phase shift. It's actually 50 times the layer thickness of change in optical thickness. Or if you wanted, I should delete this next time I show it. If you wanted to squeeze all this into simple linear refractive index, you would end up with a refractive index of minus 20. But this is a too crude way to look at it. What really happens is that the pulse enters, it completely scrambles the electronic structure of the sample. It effectuates that the sample obtains a negative derivative of the refractive index. So you get a negative group velocity. This is not forbidden. It does not defeat causality. It just means phase and group in this mysterious setting travel faster through the sample than through vacuum. And I think it's cool. If you read about electromagnetically induced transparency, one of the statements they make is, okay, the system absorbs coherence, then coherence is stored in the system, and then the system at some later time spits this out, right? Now, I think this is the opposite. The pulse enters, it itself changes the electronic structure of the sample so much that it's not allowed to be in there again anymore. So it sort of self-squeezes its the wave out at the rear side. So this is all very cool. The important message is these short pulses allow us to dramatically affect the electronic structure of matter. And then have for short moments in time, transiently, 2, 3, 4 femtoseconds, effectively have matter which has completely different electronic structure. Now, the trick would be that in future experiments, we somehow act on this completely different transient electronic structure and seek whether there's new functionality in this field rest system. Again, for short moments in time. Okay, now the last thing, what's the time? I completely lost track on the time, sorry. Okay. I think I need 11, sorry. The last thing I wanted to show you is that if you believe, and that, of course, we're not the only ones doing such experiments, but if you believe that with these short pulses, we can grab electrons effectively by their neck and move them around deliberately, the question would be this degree of control, can it be also exerted on magnetic state of matter? And this is way more complicated, of course, because we don't have a laser that emits super short magnetic pulses, right? And then also all these spins have long range interactions and extra couplings that make the time map I showed you with just electronic degrees of freedom extra complicated. Now, the question that we asked was, can we somehow hook up the response of the spin system to the very quick carrier, to the response of the electronic system, and via this pathway also affect the magnetic system very quickly? And I'll try to show you an example. So the idea put forward by theorists was, we need to look at light excitation in a heterostructure that causes a directional flow of charge. So literally in space, directional flow of charge, which I learned later for semiconductor physics is not so unusual. We call it shift current. And also in chemistry, charge transfer. Optical excitation can lead to the motion of physical motion of charge in space, right? But that's in a properly chosen system will also move a spin current, cause a spin current, a spin transport. The experiment we did is in this heterostructure. So nickel, thin layer, sandwiched between platinum ad layers. Nickel is a ferromagnet, of course. And then it has the peculiarity that optical excitations take majority states and promote it across the interface into a the initial state of the optical excitation is in the nickel. The final state can be in a band belonging to the platinum. So that means the optical excitation pushes charge from the nickel across the interface into the platinum. Platinum is not a ferromagnet, but rather has gigantic spin orbit coupling. So if charge is moved from here, it will carry its spin, and then the spin will be turned into angular orbital momentum, if you want. So that was the hypothesis. We tried to measure it with a variant of attosecond spectroscopy that we dubbed attosecond X-ray magnetic circular dichroism. The only thing I want to report is that we've seen that the magnetic moment can change by 40% in 5 femtoseconds. So that is the fastest transient of magnetic moment that has been seen in the experiment. Not because everything was so crazy smart, but because this changing magnetic moment is really associated with this optically driven current across the interface between a ferromagnet and the heavy metal. Now, we do the same experiment as a control in just the nickel. You see this also demagnetizes, but way slower than the sandwich system. And then I don't have time to compare this to theory, but this actually can this gives a lot of information for theories on dynamical aspects of magnetism to to bite their nails about. Anyways, one step smarter on top of this would be this directional, so in directional energy flow, directional charge flow across an interface as a way to manipulate magnetism. It's actually not no. Tunnel junctions work like this. So that would be a tunnel junction, right? An oxide, a transparent oxide, and then ferromagnet, ferromagnet. And this stack is very conductive if these two magnetization directions are parallel, and it's very not conductive if they're anti-parallel. So now we subjected half of such a magnetic tunnel junction to photoelectron spectroscopy. So forget all the details, dichroism measurement again. This is a photoelectron image of the magnetic domain pattern in half of a magnetic tunnel junction. And if we fire the laser, what you see is this tiger pattern turns into a stronger tiger pattern. So the magnetic moment contrast increases as a response to the optical excitation in this very system. So this is a cobalt, iron, boron ferromagnet with a magnesium oxide at top layer. And then after some time, this extra amount of magnetization vanishes slowly again. The one thing I wanted to highlight is we detect this with photoelectron dichroism measurement, and photoelectrons are, of course, energy resolved, right? So we can measure the not only the magnetic moment in a spatially resolved fashion here, we can also measure it spatially resolved. So this is how we get the tiger pattern, right? This is the magnetic domains in this half tunnel junction. And I can show you here the transients for three distinct energy intervals in the density of states where we probe that. So here close to Fermi energy, thing is pretty usual. The laser pulse comes and it demagnetizes the sample. Now that's laser-induced demagnetization known since 20 years. And what you also see as this shaded line here is the change in electron count rate. So you see after, time scale will come later, after 4 picoseconds, the electronic excitation by the light has settled again. The change in magnetic moment though has not yet settled. In another energy interval, we see an increase in magnetic moment, which is very unusual for, if you think by shining, by absorbing light by a magnetic system, in the end, you make it warmer, right? So you increase the disorder. You should expect to make it less magnetic. But in these peculiar samples, in this situation, it turns out we make it more magnetic by shining light. That's something very peculiar we are currently working in. And then, of course, there's one energy interval around the point where there's no magnetic moment before elimination. We get quite a bit of magnetic moment afterwards. And the cool thing is, don't have time to go into the details, but the number of electrons the laser pulse shuffled around as a function of time has long settled again. So this sample is not electronically excited anymore in response to the light field. It is, has just changed its magnetic moment. And not only has it changed, it has increased its magnetic moment. So we believe this is a way forward to actually some fancy functionality that we're trying to explore. So the last thing, 1 minute I still have, right? Okay, then I'll need one, and then we have to spend the other 3 minutes together in, I don't know, suggestions. I'm ready for suggestions. So I hope maybe by this attosecond is not so bad in probing charge and spin dynamics in some parameter niches. The thing now is, of course, functionality is in devices and heterostructures. Our experimental methodology so far has no spatial resolution. And that is a bit of a problem. We cannot look into a processor because that is nanoscale structures, and we probe a gigantic 500 or 50 micron blob in cross section. So why is that? Because there is no optics for the XEV lights where we synthesize the attosecond pulses. So electronic structures look like this or look like this, or plasmonic wave packets, very, very interesting coupling between charge density redistribution and electric field at surfaces. This we are doing together with the colleagues from the Wigner lab that I recently met on conference. So you recognize where the picture has been taken. So we should try to push this temporal resolution for charges and spins and combine it with spatial resolution. And 4D microscopy, I'll skip this slide. No, I won't skip it. I will just say briefly, for fancy 4D resolution, so very good spatial resolution and very good temporal resolution, you both want XUV radiation. It's short wavelength, right? You kill the numerical aperture problem, so you can get small foci with very small numerical aperture. And this is why attoseconds all the time has been into the XUV. The time bandwidth product for one femtosecond is regardless of the central wavelength. So you need 1.8 eV of bandwidth for one femtosecond pulse, and it really doesn't matter what's the carrier frequency. Now, 1.8 eV of bandwidth for a visible pulse is the entire visible light. That's hard to handle because of dispersion. Now, in XUV, it's just a fraction of the central wavelength, right? Doesn't matter, this tiny bandwidth. Okay, so XUV light for microscopy with suboptical resolution in space and time would be cool, yet there is no optics for XUV because materials are simply not transparent. You cannot make a lens for XUV because absorption is gigantic, right? We are beyond all the resonances in the Lorentz-Drude model, if that would predict the refractive index of the material. So what we tried is to apply this, the beauty of meta optics. I don't know, for the few that might be familiar with that, it's just a modern way by nanostructured devices to imprint phase shift into wavefronts we transmit. Now that makes very little sense if you haven't heard of it. But the cool thing is we noticed that silicon for some of the frequencies where we can synthesize attosecond pulses has actually refractive index of 0.7 only. So 1 minute, I assume. Okay. So the cool thing about silicon is if you drill a hole in a slab of silicon and transmit an attosecond pulse at a 50 nanometer radiation, it sees smaller than unity refractive index. So we can use a hole, the refractive index contrast between the hole and the surrounding to build a meta optic and have high transmission at the same time because the energy goes through the hole, right? So we can build a lens for XUV radiation that does not have to be transmitted through material. And then we were quite excited about it, super complicated, it focuses. We get 5% of the incoming light of our attosecond pulse into a less than 700 nanometer focus. So we think we also get less than 70 nanometer focus in the next generation and hope with that to do really sub-wavelength microscopy in time and space. Okay, I don't have time for my conclusion slide. For the one sentence I want to say is what I said in the beginning, we can create electron hole pairs, wave packets in solids very fast, right? And then there's all those nasty processes killing the coherence. Maybe there is a time domain opportunity between coherent control and the nasty processes that in the future, I hope we can explore it. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much for this very interesting talk, and we have time for one or two questions.
Yes, so concerning the second part for the lithium fluoride, can you resolve the time delay in these for these excitations?
In this particular experiment, we cannot. It would still require that we interact the sample with the third pulse to somehow, because the two pulse sequence is how we extract the signal, right? So now we would need to time this up with yet a third pulse to somehow measure response times or something. We cannot, it is certainly not out of the world experimentally, but then of course you also would need to want to talk to a theorist that is even dares to look at response times. I cannot tell how long it takes to form an electron hole pair in a solid, less than a femtosecond. I would even say less than 100 attoseconds, but then I don't know. So
I have a couple of remarks, a very exciting talk. Now, the time delay that you observed, or I shouldn't say delay, but one wave packet got faster than the other one. I remember about, 30 years ago, there were these experiments by Raymond Chow at Berkeley, where he saw the same effect.
Yes, saw the same effect. The thing I want to add there is that, you're not finished with the question.
Well, and the other one was Günther Nimtz in Cologne, where he did just experiments with microwaves.
Yes. And the thing is, this superluminal propagation of groups is observed in the presence of absorption. So if you think, again, Lorentz-Drude model, if you scan the refractive index across the absorption, beyond the absorption frequency, you get funny refractive index at the level of imaginary part, at the level of absorption that might be still acceptable. So in this very narrow frequency range for microwaves and also for optics, similar things have been seen. This now, of course, is action on an entire octave of light, right? So this is not cannot be explained in the Lorentz-Drude model, where you have sort of a beautiful excursion of the refractive index, and then you can separate. This is sort of frequency agnostic, I should say.
We should talk about it later, because somehow I don't see the absorptive part, because it was just a potential, and there's no absorption whatsoever, and the particle is tunneling through. And that's what they saw. There was, in my opinion, no absorption argument involved.
Okay.
So
I would be curious.
At least that's what I remember. Second part, the lens that you talked about.
Yes.
I was trying to understand, because we did a lot of work some time ago where we looked at focusing just from holes. And if you take just the old single slit experiment,
mm-hmm.
and you just look as the wave propagates, you'll find a point where the wave packet is narrower.
Yes,
than it was originally.
This is not the same effect. Explicitly not. What you refer to is actually optics that focus XUV would be a gigantic market if like the semiconductor industry would see this as a solution to all their problems. They use part of what you refer to and call it Talbot optics. So in the near field of such an array of holes, you find a cross section where there is sharper features than the input light. But this is explicitly not. This is a proper Gaussian focus that we can adjust any focal length you want, and it doesn't have side lobes. It's really, this is as good as Gaussian focusing gets.
Thank you very much. Maybe you can continue
after
the presentation during the poster session, so you can prepare for that.
Okay.
I mean, the time.
I'm not allowed, I think. Thanks.
Question is, how did you find
me, Fred? I think on the first slide, there was Budapest, Italy by mistake.
Ah, I think I stole it from your PDF program. No?
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.
And before you leave, Martin. Martin, before you go. This is some presents. This is to relax a bit after the long talk.
With a lot of pride.
Yeah, and this is a medal of being there.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay.